Ladies and gentlemen, Easy Aces.
Who was your announcer on that? Whose voice was that?
That was me.
It was yourself?
Yeah.
You didn't announce the program all the time?
I always did, yeah, when we were on the Easy Aces thing.
I remember Easy Aces along in the late afternoons, along with Stella Dallas and Portia Faces Life. Is that the
well,
time?
No, it was on around 7 most of the time. And then it went to 8. Last year we were on, we did a show with an audience. We expanded it to a half-hour show. And we had an audience that came in. Well, they were in there looking for a giveaway show. You know, they used to have those giveaway shows, and when they were crowded out of that, they came in to hear us, you know.
Yeah. When did you begin with Easy Aces?
Oh, we began in Kansas City, Missouri, about 1930, as Jane says, about 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Did you begin as Easy Aces? Or?
Yeah. I was working on a newspaper there. I was a drama critic of the Kansas City Journal Post. There's not much money to be made as a drama critic in Kansas City in those days. There were two theaters, one Schubert House and one other one. But you had to start, you know, making some bread someplace else, you know. And when radio came in, it was something new, you know, and if you ever had, and it was connected with our paper some way or other. And if you ever had an idea about something, you went to the manager of the station and you'd say, I have an idea. He'd say $10 before you got any further than that. Everything was $10, you know. But when we thought of this thing, when I came up with Easy Aces, he gave me 30, and he gave my wife 15, I think.
Then you got paid for each program, or you weren't selling?
We were on 3 days a week there, local. And that lasted about a year. Well, we were staying there until they took us to Chicago to make a recording of it, hoping it would go on what was known then as the chain, now on the network. And we went there, made the records, and he was supposed to be sending them around, but some guy happened to be in Kansas City, or some Chicago advertising man who heard the program 2 or 3 times. He had come in to see another client that heard it the first time and just thought he'd caught a good one, and the next one he liked, and the next one. So he came in and offered me a job going to Chicago. I was very insecure. As insecure as I am today, I guess, in those days. He offered us to pay all our fare and expenses there for 13 weeks. But I had, in meeting a lot of actors as a drama critic, I had gotten used to big money, you know. So I said, no, I won't go for less than $500. He said, okay. From nothing to $500, that was pretty good. So I got a leave of absence from the paper, thinking I'd get out of debt that way for 13 weeks. And then come back, I had a ride. I wrote a daily column. I had to continue the column from Chicago and write the show 3 times a week. We broadcast in those days in the Drake Hotel. And all the acts were there in Chicago then, Amos and Andy, Vic and Sade, Merton Wise, all the old radio acts.
It was a big hub. Radio.
And then they picked it up for another 13, another 13. Then they gave us 13 weeks off in the summer with full pay. And we came back again. I don't know how that clause got into the contract. Santa Claus, we called it. And then it came back the next year, and we had another 26 weeks. And then, unfortunately, one night, the sponsor, whom we had never met, called us from Minneapolis, a guy made Lavoris or something. And he said, you started 4 minutes late tonight. I said, no, the clock in the studio here said... He said, I have an old grandfather's clock here that hasn't lost a minute in 50 years, and got mad, and he canceled this. And we came to New York thinking we were on the way by then. You know, we thought we were famous. By the time we got here, we found we weren't that famous. And
Had you been heard in New York, though?
I think a little bit. It was through WGN, and maybe in New York the second year. And the advertising agency had a firm outlet here. After we couldn't find any work, you know, about a week or so, we didn't know what we were going to do. But I didn't care because I was pretty wealthy, but I must have had $3,000-$4,000, say that. So the sponsor, the advertising agency here in New York, had a different man ahead of it, and he liked the show, and he put us on for Anison, a brand new product. He told me I'd never heard of it before. He said they had just bought it, this drug outfit. And we went on for that, and we stayed on for about 15 years, I think, and had a 13-week contract all that time.
Easy Aces was one of the last strip shows to go off, as I recall.
Was it? Well,
what year did it go
on? We could have stayed on. I don't know when it was, but it was during during the war years, 1344 or so. I don't remember. I know we went on, and we went on as an hour show later, but as a half-hour show. But we had never heard from that sponsor either. And I had introduced a new kind of a musical bridge between the scenes. Instead of having the an organist or somebody play a little music leading out of the scene, I thought it would be nice to have a little quartet there at my own expense and have them sing the lyrics, so like if Jane was asking for a mink coat or something. I have a record of it. I would like to have you here. And then at the end of that, the orchestra would play Button Up Your Overcoat or something like that. And we did that for a while. And we had some letters complaining, why are you playing those records up there? And here I had this combo there and some four singers, you know. And then afterwards, people began writing it like it. Well, the sponsor probably just heard it late. He never listened, I guess. And he wrote a note that said, I don't like the musical bridges you're using now at all. Take them out. So I wrote back a note saying, we've been on now for about 16 years for him, 15 years for him, I think. I said, I don't like the way you're packing the Anison tablets now. You used to pack them in tin boxes, and now you got them in cardboard. This was during the war. Well, he thought of an answer to that, which was you're fired, which was all right with us, but we'd never had a vacation in all that time. You know, we worked summer and all the time, and this agency, Black & Sample Lambert, had about 78 to 80 shows, I understand, on the air, selling it. But they never believed in the rating system.
All the Hummert shows, Frank and Ann Hummert.
That's right.
You weren't one of theirs, though.
Yes.
Well, you were.
Only I wrote our stuff. They outlined and hired writers to write all theirs. I wrote my own outline of and wrote it myself. And they believed in only the cash register. If the product was selling, that was good enough for them. They didn't want to fool around with ratings. Their show never had top ratings, but they were selling. They said that our show, without any other advertising, when we went on for the Anison the first time, it was a new product, had increased the sales in 1 year 900%. This was something that came from the company itself in a pamphlet that they had sent around, and I haven't seen. So that was their only, they only went by that. I heard from Ann Hummert once, somewhere about 7 or 8 years after we'd been on. She said, I happened to catch your show last night, and I think it's one of the best, you know. And I wrote and said, you caught us on an off night. We're not usually that good. And that was our relationship, you know. They were very nice people. She's a wonderful woman. She's still around. Very, very nice woman.
She still sees Arthur Hughes.
Arthur Hughes,
been on the program.
Yeah.
It was just plain Bill.
Mm-hmm.
They're still friendly. We better explain, because a lot of people, I think, tuned in to hear a program about Easy Aces and find that Jane Ace is not here. Now, you better tell them why she isn't.
Well, Jane is busy doing her own thing. She doesn't know about this. She doesn't know. She hardly knows what I'm doing. I told her about this book, and she liked it. You know, it comes in a cellophane wrapper. She's never even unwrapped it. She shows it to the maids or anybody that comes up to the apartment or something.
It is. It's wrapped up like a sirloin steak at the
supermarket. Well, that's because there's a little recording inside of it of our voices. If you care for nostalgia, you can get about 6 or 8 minutes, I think, both sides of a little recording in the book.
The book is called Ladies and Gentlemen, Easy Aces, which is how this program began, thanks to the recording that's tucked inside it. And I guess, as you say, that's why it's wrapped in cellophane, and it's published by Doubleday. It's a nice Christmas gift, I think, for anyone interested in nostalgia, which most of the people.
Yeah, well, I've been getting on the side. I do a column for the Saturday Review, which I've done for some years. you know, 2 weeks after I... It used to be known as the Saturday Review of Literature, and 2 weeks after I joined it, they dropped the of literature, which I like to think was coincidental. But I had a column in there about the book recently, because I had been getting letters from people, well, not a lot, but some letters, saying where can they get scripts, where can they hear the recordings. And so I decided to... I think they have eight of our scripts in there with some dialogue between Jane and me and picking out the scripts, which we probably almost went through word for word. There is a preface. She didn't want it at all. She didn't want it to be... I said, you'll become immortal. She said, oh, no, it's going to be one of those kind of books. And I don't want anybody... I said, you know, one of those things. It really... most of it actually happened. She used malaprops so often on the show that... Now, it's a sort of an occupational hazard.
The mistress of the malaprop.
That's right. Well, malaprop was... I didn't invent that. That was invented by a man named Sheridan, who wrote a play called The Rivals, which opened in 1775. I happened to be there opening night, I guess. And I saw this... the woman in that was known as Mrs. Malaprop. It's taken from the French mal apropos, meaning out of place, something that doesn't fit. And he uses our malaprops for words that, actual words. See, Amos and Andy used the words like eyes regusted. There's no such word as regusted. Our words are actually words, but they're the wrong words. They're not puns, particularly.
Your wife, I think, and Samuel Goldwyn are the two most famous.
Yeah, that's right. Well, Samuel Goldwyn, I think... he was groping for a word. You know, Jane did them by script. But now, after all these years, we try to use, in the scripts, we try to use words that had some, that were meaningful. You know, like, well, she went down to the poor neighborhoods, you know, to the slums one day with her, in her car. And she came home and told me she saw all those Old Testament houses there. It said a little something. Be it ever so hovel, there's no place like home. You know, there are some things that are picture gags, like where you're running through like a chicken with his hat off. This is not exactly a malaprop. Not the kind I prefer.
Do people all want to know what Jane Ace is really like?
Yeah, they always ask that. And I always tell them what she's really like. She's just a... she never was an actress, you know. She never... she was just a housewife when I told her we were going to do this show. And she was for anything in those days. Okay, let's do it.
She had no theatrical background.
Not at all. Mm-hmm. I think she said she took, 1 year of elocution. She was telling me this one day when we were talking about cooking. She said, we always order room service. But she says, you know, if I have to, you know, I can strangle an egg. These aren't things that she, these are things that we must have had in the script someplace. And she just, you know, and she always looks, she says, is that correct? And I say, yeah, I think so. You know, I just let her go. And she told me she took domestic silence in school for a long time. But she hasn't been practicing, I'll tell you that.
How long have you been married?
I've been married quite a long while. It's about, about 40 years, I guess.
Did you know when you worked out of Chicago, did you get to know the writer of Vic and Sade?
No, I never did.
Reimer?
Paul Reimer. I never got to know anybody. You know, I was just so busy writing. You have to write a script every day, you know, keep ahead. And when we came to New York, it was five times a week, and then it changed to three times a week. But you had to start new storylines and... See, it was the kind of a fun thing in those days. It's different from television, definitely.
Was Mr. Ace's profession ever disclosed?
I was in the real estate business, I think, sometime in the thing. And then another time later in the script I went into the advertising business. And our stories were around that, the advertising business was when we did the Hour Show.
But you had no children on the program.
No children.
Have you children?
We had, no. We had a friend, Marge, who used to laugh. See, there were no laugh tracks in those days. And we had no audience in our studio when we did the 15-minute show. So every time Jane used the malaprop, Marge would laugh as she spoke the next line. So The audience will know it was time to laugh, I suppose. That's one of the things that's bad about television now. They have laugh tracks on everything. You know, somebody walks to the door to answer a doorbell. There's a little laugh follows them to the door. The film is laced with laughter, you know.
Yeah, it's very off-putting.
Yes, it is. And it's bad. And it hurts the level of comedy because a writer in the old days of radio used to have to wonder whether a line would get a laugh. And work on it, fashion it, because some lines miss by not being correctly phrased, you know. But nowadays, you know darn well it's going to get a laugh because there's a guy standing there with that machine putting laughs in, you know.
Did you miss the show when it went off after so long?
No, it was kind of a relief, actually. I got busy right away and started doing other things.
Didn't it come back for a while as Mr. Ace and Jane?
That was the hour show.
Was that network or local?
That was network. That was the hour show that we did. We never got a rating there either. We always had bad ratings, but we always seemed to run into people that seemed to have heard it, you know, somehow or other. I guess they had different rating systems in those days, but it's still the same idea. People nowadays, they have an attachment in their set that the Nielsen people give them two shiny bright quarters, you know, when they drop out of this thing if you stay home and monitor your set. You can turn on your set and go to a movie and leave it turned on and you'll still be considered a viewer, you know.
Did you have fun when you were writing The Big Show? That was one of your...
Well, that was one of the things I read. That was hard work. That was an hour and a half radio show, and there's no dancing groups or very much. But it was just real straight writing, and that was difficult. I took that show at about... I think they offered me $750. My agent just didn't want it at all. He wanted to get 10% of a higher fee. But I took it just because I thought it was a kind of a challenge. And it turned out to be 2 years of very hard work, you know, 7 days a week and two nights, practically. But it was worth it, you know. It was some satisfaction in knowing you were writing some a little higher level of comedy.
Yeah, that was very well remembered. It was sort of the last days of
that
big radio.
That was the last gas. Well, they were pretty mad around NBC in those days, too, that we were taking this money away from television, which was just starting, you see. But Bud Bailey, who was in charge of radio, kept putting on a show. We had a lot of big guests. You know, on one show, we could have with Salula, the hostess, we could have Ethel Barrymore, Bob Hope, Groucho Marx, Jerry Lewis, and Dean Martin. They have any number of guests. They all got the minimum fee, which was hardly anything.
I didn't know that.
Oh, yes. I think they got coolie wages, I think, about
it. Well, why was that? Because it was
because
still big money?
Because it was a prestige show after a while, and it was only one day's rehearsal. It was difficult writing, but one day's rehearsal, we kind of come in on a Friday, read the script, and come back on Sunday for a dress rehearsal and do it, and that was it.
Was it done live?
Oh, yes. From the center there. We even went to England with it and did a show from London, and then we did one from Paris with it, too.
Yeah, and Tallulah Bankhead was the hostess. Meredith Wilson was a regular.
He was a regular. He sure was, yeah.
Was there anyone else who was on every week? I was trying to think.
Well, Fred Allen was on quite a number of times because he had a contract with NBC, which paid him whether he worked or not.
How did you get along with Miss Bankhead?
I got along fine. I mean, I never bothered. I had a little problem at the start. She came up to see the script. She didn't know us. We didn't know her. But I knew her as a character. You see, she brought us a character. All we had to do was just put it down on paper. That makes it less difficult. If you get somebody that nobody knows and you have to build a character, it's tougher. So she came in and to read the first script. Came in with slacks at half mast, you know, with red lipstick down by her chin. She had missed her lips this day. And she sat down and started with page one. And she said, "What does this line mean here?" or something. And I tried to explain it to her. And she said, "Well, it won't get any laughs." I says, "I'll bet you $1 it does." She didn't know who I was or who these other boys. She says, "Are you gentlemen the authors?" That's the way. Being called an author in television was pretty good for us. And I said, "Yes, ma'am." And she says, "Well, of course, It'll get a laugh because you gentlemen will be here with your little clack laughing it up. And I said, not me. I'll be at home listening to Armis Brooks. She says, what's that? I says, well, Armis Brooks is played by Eve Arden. She's on opposite us. She's a great comedian. You know, well, she didn't like that at all, you know. And then we came to a part where we had written some dialogue for her and Ethel Merman to do, in which they traded insults, you know. So they said, when I first came on the show, they had two other writers on it, which, who were serious writers. And when Ethel Merman was, that night, our opening night, was to sing the entire score of Call Me Madam, which was going to open, which had opened the night before our show, with Russell Knight and Paul Lucas. And when she finished singing, it ran about 8 minutes. She was going to get a terrifically big hand. And they had written, thank you, Ethel. And you must come and see us again sometime. So thank you, DeLuca. I will. Thank you, Ethel. And good night. Thank you, DeLuca. And so I said to the producer, I said, does Miss Merman get paid for this? He says, oh, yes, everybody gets paid. I said, why do you keep thanking her? He says, well, it's a custom. And I said, well, why don't we write something in DeLuca style? So he says, well, let's see it. So it started out after she did bring the house down with us applause, DeLuca seething with envy now, said, thank you, Ethel, and better luck next time. And then it went from there. She said, I didn't want to bother you. She said, looks like you've got another hit play, Ethel. You've had about, it's going to run 2 years. You've had about 30 hits that have run 2 years each. And she said, I don't know. I'll look it up in my bank book. And she said, I don't want to bother you about tickets. I know everybody's bothering you. And she said, nonsense. I had two for you, but they were way back in the fourth row and knowing your eyes, you know. And that's the way it went. And I handed it to the producer, and he just waited. He didn't even read it. He says, it seems long. And I said, well, maybe it's short. How do we know? And it was, because I started adding to it and brought Paul Lucas into it. And then she wanted that out. She didn't want Ethel to have half the line. She said, it's my show. She's been singing here for 8 minutes. Why shouldn't I have all the jokes? And I tried to explain to her that that's the way it's done it. Start. I said, Jack Benny doesn't get all the laughs. What she said about Jack Benny is unprincipled. She said, I don't give a damn what he does. And then on the day of the show, I said, why don't we try it? And to my surprise, on the day of our Sunday rehearsal, the show we were going to do that night, Ethel was complaining that she didn't want the Lula to have half the jokes. Fortunately, Fred Allen was on the show, and he acted as the go-between. He calmed them both down in a nice, easy manner. You know, he's such a gentleman, you know. And they went through with it, and that became the pattern of the show.
Have you ever tried writing for a big name and found you just couldn't?
A lot of times, but you have to do it. Once you find, you put a piece of blank paper in a typewriter, which I do practically every day, and say, now I got to write 780 words on this subject for the Saturday Review or something, and you don't think you can. And you do it. You sit there and you do it, that's all. And you find you've got 900, now you have to cut. But writing for, you always try to find something. You see, we never had Tallulah say the same thing to Marlena Dietrich as a guest, for instance, that she would say to Ginger Rogers. Now, Marlena Dietrich, you can say that's a beautiful gown you're wearing and talk about gowns. You can also say it to Ginger Rogers, but we try to find something as peculiar to Ginger, like, well, we found out that she likes to play golf. She's an outdoors girl. So that was our topic with her. We always found something that we could, that would be peculiar to the person that was our guest, you know.
WBAI, New York.
There were two skits that Miss Bankhead did on the big show that I remember very well, and I wonder if you wrote either or both of them. One was the day that it was all Tallulah Bankhead taking a ride on the subway.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you how that happened.
She wanted them to take her check when she got...
You know how that happened? I guess I can tell it now, but in those days, Dorothy Parker was suspect, you know. Mm-hmm. Those were terrible days. And she used to do a Dorothy Parker thing every week. And nobody could write that well, none of us. But, and it never got any laughs because it was prose and it wasn't set up for jokes, you know.
It's very poignant thing.
Telephone call she did. Well, we used to do one of them, but on a Friday they threw us a curve and said no more Dorothy Parker. And they had gone to the coast to do the show. The writers stayed here.
It was because of the blacklist.
Pardon? Yes.
Yeah.
The writers stayed here. And they called and told us, and I said, no sweat, we'll write something. And the girl said, oh, come on, you, with all due respect to you, gentlemen, she liked us a little bit. Now, you can't write like Dorothy Parker. I said, of course not. So we wrote the subway thing. The idea, I said to my other writers, I said, let's get her up against conformity and whatever people take for granted, you know, taking a driving lesson or whatever it is. And yes, and just and we sent it out to the coast, and it worked well. So we wrote one almost every week.
The other one that I remember very well was the day her maid didn't show up or was on vacation, and she began her day by looking for the toast throughout the kitchen.
Oh yes, that's right. Out of the kitchen, through the kitchen, and everything. I remember those. She even called me about a couple years ago one day. And said that she had a chance to go on another show, the Hollywood Palace, and wanted my permission to use going to the beauty shop, which I didn't even remember whether I wrote or not. I said, yeah, you can use it as far as I'm concerned. I said, I don't know if I wrote it. She said, oh, I'm sure you did, and I never heard any more about it.
Then I discussed that show with her when I saw her one day I spent with
her
before she died. No, I did a very long program. It turned out to be very long because I couldn't get her to quiet long enough to say goodnight. It ended up, I spent, I think, about 4 or 5 hours with her. And she told me that she thought that show, the big show, probably did more for her than anything else in her career because she was really known as a stage actress. She had bombed in films other than one success film.
She was a great stage actress, I think.
But she became a household word after that.
And, you know, she never mentioned us in the book, never mentioned the writer. She mentioned Meredith Wilson. She mentioned D. Engelbach, who produced, you know him, he produced the show. And that was it.
Writers are people that...
They're on the lowest, lowest rung of the social ladder. That's somebody, you know, after they get an electrician and a sound man and everything else that you need, the cameras and everything, somebody says, gee, don't you ought to get some writers? Or, yeah, I guess so. They don't like to think they have writers, a lot of them. They like to think they're actually saying those things. As a matter of fact, one sample of that, I always tell, I don't know if you know, if you've heard this, stop me. We were writing a spot for her and George Sanders one time. And I had come up with my writers were sitting. I was sitting at the typewriter, and I had written, George, I envy you. You do so many wonderful things. You're an actor, you're a singer, you're a composer, you play the piano, you play the organ, you're an interior decorator, you just invented something for the Navy and everything. And going, how do you do all these things? And that's as far as we got, and we couldn't think of another line. We knew that George did well with short answers. And we couldn't think of anything. And we sat there for about a half hour. You know, usually you go right on to something, but I knew there was a good joke there someplace. And we couldn't. And George Sanders happened to come to town the day before, a day early. And he walked in and he said, good morning, gentlemen. I said, hey, you're just in time, George. I said, you really believe you say all these things anyhow. Now's your time to create. I said, and I told him what the straight line was, and she said, how do you do all these things? He said, I'll be glad to help you. And he sat down for about 10 minutes, and he was getting red in the face. And finally, he said, well, I'm sure you gentlemen will think of something. And he walked out. Well, we didn't, and we went on to something else. The rest of the script, when I got home after dinner that night, I have a funnier typewriter at home or something. I put it in, and it came to him. He said, how do you do all these things? He said, magnificently. So the next day in the hall, I had just picked up the copies of the script, and we were going to rehearsal, and I saw him. I said, hey, George, here's your script. And he said, oh, thank you. I said, by the way, we thought of a line for that, where she said, how do you do all these things? You say, magnificently. And he thought for a moment, and he said, naturally. And that was it, you know, because what else would I say?
Goodman Ace was good enough to come here today and talk with me, so I thought I want to mention his book again. Because it's Christmas time, a lot of people are looking for gifts. The publisher is Doubleday, and it's called Ladies and Gentlemen, Easy Aces. And it's the scripts, the old scripts that we remember so well from the 30s and 40s, the Easy Aces scripts. And they're all here with pictures of Goodman and Jane Ace. What are you doing now? We've got about a minute. You can tell me quickly.
I know we're working on Saturday Review. And outside of that, I pretend a lot. I pretend this is an important thing that I'm doing, writing his book. I pretend that I understand what the kids want, and I pretend I understand what's in the newspapers. That's about all. I have a lot of other things I do. I got another book that I just finished, a book of Saturday Review pieces that I collected, and I've written some stuff for that. And I'm doing a biographical autobiography thing called Capital I for Simon & Schuster, which will be due last December.
Well, good luck with all of them, particularly ladies and gentlemen, Easy Aces, which I say again is published by Doubleday. And until next week at the same time, this is Richard Bamparsky thanking Goodman Ace for coming here and checking himself for my interviewing, and you for listening. Good night.